From NPR and WBUR, I'm Eric Westervelt.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. Former FBI Director James Comey's book, A Higher Loyalty, officially goes on sale today. And he's coming under increasing scrutiny for things he's written, and he's pushing back. On NPR's Morning Edition today, host Steve Inskeep pressed Comey on whether his message in the book is undermined by some of his personal observations about President Trump, such as how orange Trump's face is or that his hands are not really all that small.
I'm not making fun of the president. I'm trying to be an author, which I've never been before in my life. But while I'm typing, I can hear my editor's voice ringing in my head. Bring the reader with you. Show them inside your head. Bring them with you.
Describe the president's hands. Can you hear the editor saying that?
No, but that was on my mind. And by the way, not that this matters, but I found his hands to be above average in size.
Steve Inskeep joins us now to talk about this. Steve, welcome.
It's great to be back.
Let's listen to a little bit more of James Comey. Here's what he told you about why he wrote this book.
So there's a thing, a set of values that's above our normal fights. And what I'm worried about with this president is he threatens those. And if we lose those, if those norms are degraded, those values are degraded, what are we exactly?
So Comey talks a great deal about his values and about keeping trust in the FBI, the big picture. Mm-hmm. But what did he tell you about the smaller picture, that he was making crucial decisions about whether to make public certain aspects of the investigation into Hillary Clinton's emails and Donald Trump's ties to Russia, or not to make those things public, based on things that were extraneous to the law? You asked him about that.
Oh, yes. So much to discuss here, Lisa. And in fact, the decision by James Comey to write a book about these matters is a kind of microcosm of his earlier decisions to talk about these criminal matters, because the question is, how much should law enforcement officials, the FBI, federal prosecutors, be talking in public about criminal investigations or other kinds of investigations that aren't fully resolved, that have not ended up in an indictment? He's chosen, again, to go public with this story in a very dramatic way with this book and a series of interviews, including with us. But he, as he knows, could still be a witness in a criminal investigation.
So does that not concern him? I mean, why is he saying he came forth with the book now, then, considering the investigations are still ongoing?
Well, let's think this through. He says that he came out with a book now because this is when the publisher said the publishing date was, and he had finished the book. And he clearly felt that he had something to say to the country. When asked, however, why would you take the risk, in effect, of writing this book, given that it could mess up someone's criminal investigation, he said, my story's already out there. I've already testified under oath. And his story doesn't change, actually, all that much. If you read the book, you see something like his congressional testimony from a year ago. If you interview him, you hear something like what's in the book.
What did he say in response to your question about the decision that he made to talk about Hillary Clinton's emails and the status of the investigation into that when, as he had in mind, the timing of the election?
Yeah, it's clear that politics was part of this, even though he says his motivation was to make a non-political decision. But sometimes these terms turn back on themselves, don't they? He acknowledges that he was thinking about the roar on cable television about Hillary Clinton, about the investigation of her emails, about whether the FBI had been compromised in some way, and he was trying to fend that off and protect his institution. That sounds an awful lot like public relations. That sounds an awful lot like politics. But Comey argues that it is the essence of his job. And he's not the only person who led an institution who feels that way, that the first job or one of the first jobs is to protect the institution.
Comey told Congress last year about what he said Donald Trump told him in a private meeting. Comey testified that Trump said, I hope you can let this go, referring to the investigation into Michael Flynn, who was the national security advisor at the time. You asked Comey about whether in that congressional testimony he laid out a case for obstruction of justice. Here's part of that conversation.
I hope I didn't testify publicly that it was obstruction of justice.
You didn't say obstruction of justice. Yeah. People just felt you were laying out the evidence for it.
Oh, I see.
But you look at that same evidence and don't see obstruction.
Well, because I can't see all of it. And it could be obstruction of justice. It would depend upon what the full scope of the evidence is with respect to intent, because obstruction of justice requires a demonstration of corrupt intent. And I'm just a witness when it comes to that particular incident.
How do you read that answer, Steve?
I think that when you hear the way that Comey is conditional about many of the things that he says, you hear several things. First, he's extremely smart. There's no doubt about it. Second, he is very careful. You could argue that James Comey made the choices he did in 2016 because he was trying to be extraordinarily careful to uphold the reputation of the FBI and, by extension, his own reputation. Extraordinarily careful, thinking extremely hard about what to do, which sounds like a very good thing, but I think that some of his critics would say that in these occasions, perhaps he thought a little too hard.
Stefanski, final question, just very briefly. What was your own takeaway from the interview, from your discussions with him, from reading the book as well?
Well, he's a talented writer, and we'll see where he goes with that. And he, however, has a complicated story. And he himself acknowledges, as you hear, it's not clear that from his story alone that you could prove obstruction of justice on the part of the president.
Stefanski, host of NPR's Morning Edition, thank you.
Glad to do it.
State officials in South Carolina are still piecing together what happened at a deadly prison riot early Sunday night. Seven inmates were killed and 17 injured at Lee Correctional Institution, a maximum security state prison, about 60 miles east of the capital, Columbia. The South Carolina Department of Corrections says the riot was likely gang-related. A warning to listeners, we'll be discussing some graphic scenes of violence. Andrew Brown has been covering the story for the Post and Courier newspaper. Andrew, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So this fight broke out Sunday night and lasted for 7 hours. What more can you tell us about what happened? What sparked the melee?
It's unclear at this point exactly what started the fighting, but what we do know from official reports from the State Department of Corrections is that prisoners began some sort of altercation. The correctional officers on duty had to back out of the three units where this fighting occurred. And because of short staffing at the prison itself, they were unable to retake those units and bring control to the prison until around 11:30 to 2 o'clock the next morning.
Seven inmates killed and more than a dozen wounded. Were these from prison-made shivs and shanks or from beatings? What?
I was at the prison yesterday. I was talking to family members of people who were in prison. One mother apparently awoke on Sunday night to images of four bodies piled on top of one another. One of the inmates had his throat slashed. Another seemed to have his head severely smashed. And according to other videos that came out of the prison as well, reportedly from contraband cell phones that were snuck into the prison, bodies had actually been dragged across the prison floors and out into the yard where they were stacked next to a fence.
About those gruesome cell phone videos, I mean, cell phones aren't allowed in the prison, but the prison doesn't seem to be able to effectively block and ban and control the devices, correct?
Correct. Our Department of Corrections director in the state, Brian Sterling, has made it a campaign of his to try and convince the Federal Communications Commission to allow the state government to block cell phone signals coming into and out of the prisons. For over a year now, they've really had a hardened campaign of trying to cut down on the smuggling of cell phones into state prisons. But again, the Federal Communications Commission has not given the state the approval to block those signals.
So blocking cell phone coverage isn't a technical issue. It's a legal one right now, Andrew, yeah?
That is correct. They have the ability to block those cell phone signals. Even our governor, Governor Henry McMaster, has made it a point to essentially call for the federal government to give the state that power.
Andrew, South Carolina has struggled with prison violence in recent months. Last month at the same prison, a correctional officer was held hostage for more than 90 minutes. What's driving the violence here and at other prisons in the state?
You know, yesterday the governor and Brian Sterling, our Department of Corrections director, came out and said that they believe what happened on Sunday was somewhat of a turf war between rival prison gangs, possibly. We have no evidence of that yet to really prove that, but essentially, a lot of the violence people are starting to assume is somewhat of a result of understaffing at these state prisons. As we reported yesterday, in the cell blocks that were overtaken, there were only six officers. That left two officers for 250 to 260 inmates in each cell block.
So, Andrew, staffing is a challenge. What about training for correctional officers? Is that a challenge as well?
The difficulty with training officers is that they are leaving so quickly. There's a higher turnover rate in the state prisons, which makes it difficult to keep experienced correctional officers on staff and at the ready. You know, these correctional officers make around $35,000 per year whenever they're first hired on. It's not a large amount of money for the job that they are doing, which is extremely dangerous, obviously. And so that leaves a lot of new hires and people who are less experienced in these situations manning these prisons throughout the state. That seems to be the real difficulty.
Andrew Brown is a reporter for the Post and Courier newspaper in South Carolina. Thank you.
Thank you.
Gregory Pardlow won the Pulitzer Prize in 2015 for his poetry collection, Digest. In his new book, he turns to prose, interweaving memory with family history and reflections on being Black in America. It's called Air Traffic, a memoir of ambition and manhood in America. And Gregory Pardlow joins us now from NPR's studios in New York to talk about the book. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks a lot, Eric. It's great to be here.
Let's start with the title, Air Traffic. Your father was a member of PATCO, the Professional Air Traffic Controllers Organization, in the late 70s up until 1981. For most of us, you know, our jobs and our sense of self are wrapped together a bit, and that seemed to be the case with your father. Being an air traffic controller, it was an intense job, you know, really shaped him and in some ways how he raised you, yes?
Absolutely, and I think probably all the more intense because as an air traffic controller, the only job that you're trained for and qualified to do is to sit in that tower. There aren't many transferable skills. So his identity was very much wrapped up in being on that microphone, speaking to the airplanes and conducting things in the air, which he brought home with him, that sense of ego, domination. I think there's a little more than your garden variety masculinity going on in that identity.
Right. And he became a local union leader and he was, you know, a charismatic public speaker. He kind of became the voice of the local union. And as you write, he loved to be the center of attention. He had this sense, you know, of sort of your family's exceptionalism.
Well, it was more his own exceptionalism, which he then extended to his wife and his kids, who were pretty much, to his mind, extensions of himself. A lot of his motivation in life, I think, was sort of rooted in the tensions he had with his father, which then get played out in his relationships to institutions, his relationships to community, his relationships, as I say, to his family, his wife and kids.
Let's get a better sense of your dad. He's a big part of this book. I mean, he would give you these challenges. I mean, you're right. It was kind of like the bridge keeper in Monty Python. He'd ask sometimes random or intense questions or, you know, to define words. Can I have you read that section? Maybe just set it up real quick and then read that.
It was a punishment that he, well, that was the context that he gave me this exercise in. But the outcome was that I actually gained a love for language and a love for discovering new words and words that are just sort of outside of my vocabulary. My father devised punishments that were cunning and proud. He dropped the family dictionary like a Christmas ham on my rickety desk and gave me, with no more to go on than the mere attire of its pronunciation, an unfamiliar word. Disconsolate, for example. He would enunciate the word with the monotone of a spelling bee announcer. I had to find the definition of the word and then find, in that definition, another word I did not understand. I was then to look up that subsequent word and so on until I could prove to my father's satisfaction that I understood every word in the definition clearly, verifying the lexical descent from my original word, at which point he might or might not assign me a new word.
So he'd give you these forms of punishment, but you'd end up understanding new and different words all the time.
And I think that some of that was my resistance to him punishing me, right? So if he was going to impose this on me as a punishment, I was going to, I'm admitting to having the chip on my shoulder now, I was going to turn that around and make it useful for me, enjoy it, actually. It made a huge impact on my imagination, my sense of my relationship to the language, and the way I related to my father through language. Mm.
Poetry, in the end, kind of saves you, and you owe some of that to your dad.
I even bristle now, you know, as a middle-aged man. My father's been gone for a couple of years, and I still bristle.
The shadow looms large.
The shadow looms large, absolutely.
All right.
But yeah, of course, that's absolutely true, yeah.
Then came what you call the defining moment in your dad's life when the Air Traffic Controllers Union decided to go on strike in 1981. President Ronald Reagan ordered everyone back to work within 48 hours or be fired. And Reagan ended up firing more than 11,000 PATCO workers and banning them from federal employment for life. And your father was one of them. He was suddenly without this job that had been such a big part of his life, had been a big part of the middle-class family you guys had built. That firing ended up sort of shaping a lot of your childhood.
It was a pivotal moment in my own life. I mean, I was 12 years old when I remember walking the picket line with him, and people were throwing food at us from cars on the highway and honking and shouting, you know, profanities at us as they went by. And it was really disillusioning. It was really, if not just confusing to me, because I was so certain of the righteousness of what we were doing.
Your dad struggles to bounce back. He eventually does. And you yourself seem to struggle to find your place in the world. I mean, you dropped out of college twice. You try the Marine Corps. That doesn't work out either. You total your new car and the debt ends up sort of following you around. And, you know, and yet you do keep bouncing back. And you may bristle at this, but, you know, part of that resilience perhaps came from your dad and him bouncing back from the PATCO strike?
It did. Yeah, it absolutely did. Now, and this is the double-edged sword, or, you know, whatever metaphor I want to use, double-edged coin.
That'll
or
work.
Two-sided coin, rather. Mm-hmm. That'll work. On the one hand, the resiliency I learned from my father because, you know, as I've said many times, you know, I also feel uncomfortable not centering my mother in these conversations because our survival could not have occurred had it not been for her resourcefulness. Mm. But my father's sort of working through his own demons and his own screw-ups, right? He managed to sink a couple of jobs after the strike even. Mm. But his resilience was absolutely a model for me. But the other side of that is I have found in the past myself playing out this narrative in which I am living into some inevitable crisis that is going to be a turning point in my life. And all that produced was a series of unnecessary moments of self-sabotage. Mm. So while I was persevering, I had also been creating the problems through which I needed to persevere. Yeah, it's complicated, I'll say.
Growing up in South Jersey, you write that both you and your father would sort of extol the idea of, you know, the first black person to X or Y. And, you know, this was something you both aspired to for yourselves well into the 90s. But then you write that one of the more destructive ideas to be planted in the souls of black folks is that of the talented 10th, W.B. Du Bois's idea, the idea that some elite African Americans should be responsible for shattering racial stereotypes.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you see that as destructive now? You see it as elitist? What?
Well, first of all, it divides a population into a 10% and a 90%. And it says that the 10% is responsible for the improvement in life experience of the 90%. That puts a lot of pressure on anyone who is inclined to see themselves as part of that 90%. Second of all, it forces one to imagine that the community, however we conceive of that community, actually wants my, for example, leadership or needs my leadership. I think there's a kind of built-in condescension when we say, I am better than 90% of the people whom we identify in America as African American. Back to your point that you raise, the idea of being the first black person to do something, you have to first agree that black people are not part of the general population, that the achievements within this community are not consistent with the achievements of people throughout the rest of society. Mm.
Gregory, it seems poetry certainly gave you a big direction in life, and yet you don't talk about it that much in the book. Why is that?
I didn't want to go down the rabbit hole. I can be really geeky when I talk about poetry. And the language that I have for poetry is all steeped in kind of literary theory and as I say, really—
You'd have to get academic on me, is what you're saying.
I'd have to get all academic up in there. Okay. And I wanted to withhold that, you know, spare readers from my enthusiasm.
Fair enough. Alcoholism plays a big role in this. Your brother struggles with it. And then through that, you realize you have a drinking problem.
Well, I knew it long before my brother struggled with it, but yeah.
Well, I guess you confront your drinking problem.
I confront it, yeah.
You know, in a deeper way. I'm curious, mm-hmm. what do you think your dad would think of this work? He died before you were able to finish it.
I think he would be comfortable with the book. And I think he would find some way, in fact, even to be proud of the book. And I don't think he would disagree with my representation of us as a family. Mm-hmm. He would challenge me on it, certainly.
Sure.
I think that would be an interesting conversation.
Right.
But I don't think he would say anything was wrong.
Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Gregory Pardlow's new book is Air Traffic, a memoir of ambition and manhood in America. Gregory, it was a pleasure.
Oh, pleasure's mine. Thank you.
This podcast and following message are sponsored by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? Every business needs great people and a way to find them. Something more than posting your job online and just praying for the right people to see it. ZipRecruiter revolutionized hiring. Their technology finds great candidates for you. It learns what you're looking for, identifies people with the right experience, and invites them to apply to your job. Right now, listeners can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/here. That's /HERE. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
In elephant news, we've got something good to report about one large elephant family in Tanzania that recently got a little bit larger with a new set of twins. Now, twin elephants are rare, but twin elephants born to a 57-year-old matriarch, that's one for the record books. The middle-aged mama is a matriarch named Eloise, and here to tell us her story and that of her now 8-month-old twins named Emma and Elon Tusk is Vicky Croak. I can hear you giggling in the background. Our guide to the animal world. Vicky, how big a deal is this double birth?
Hey, Lisa. Pretty significant. Experts say that only about 1% of elephant conceptions result in twins. And you add in the fact that Eloise, the mother, is 57 years old. Past the age of 50, elephants can still conceive, but reproduction generally has started slowing down from the age of 50 on.
But not so much for Eloise.
Right. Eloise is the oldest known elephant to give birth to twins. Considering how much sad news we hear about elephant populations in general, this is a really heartening event. And I talked to Dr. Charles Foley. He's with the Wildlife Conservation Society. And he's been following this group and this population of elephants in Tarangire National Park in northern Tanzania for 25 years. These twins were born back in August, and he gave us the latest status report on them.
Fortunately, this year, we had some good early rains leading to lots of green grass. And the last time we saw the twins, which was approximately 2 weeks ago, they were looking well padded and in very good health. So we think that they are going to survive.
Now, that's a ringing endorsement from a scientist.
So was he worried about whether they would actually make it?
Dr. Foley told me that the first time he saw the twins, when they were about 3 months old, they looked emaciated and lethargic, and he just wasn't at all sure they were going to make it. It's tough for a mother elephant to feed two fast-growing babies. Among elephant twins, mortality rates are higher, and things can even be tougher when a twin is a male. As Foley explained, males have higher growth rates and greater milk demands, and that can lead to competition between the twins. The males can even bully their sisters over access. Yet, in these circumstances, it's the male twin who's less likely to survive.
So how did, and there's a male and a female here, how did Elon and Emma go from emaciated to, as the doctor said, well padded?
They've been able to put on a couple of hundred pounds each, and that's because they had several lucky cards in their deck. For one thing, Eloise is the matriarch. Older elephants are often wiser elephants. She's big, and as Charles says, Eloise has no qualms about throwing her weight around to claim a place at waterholes or fruiting trees. Then those early rains brought green grass to eat. The twins are nursing, which baby elephants continue to do for 3 to 5 years. But they're already starting to feed themselves grass. The great thing is that Elon, the boy, has shown no aggression toward his sister.
What a good boy. So how safe are the elephants for the long term then?
Elephant populations in Africa have been devastated by poaching, reduced by about 30% in just one seven-year period from 2007 to 2014. But Tarangire National Park itself, Foley says, is one of the safest parks for elephants in Africa. It's relatively small, has good security, strong presence of park rangers, and is popular with tourists, which help keep down poaching in the ecosystem. In an important census that took place in 2014, Foley points out that Tarangire was found to be one of the few parks in Africa where the elephant population had increased by more than 5% over a five-year period. So high hopes.
Excellent. Vicky Croak, author, journalist, primate, and host of the blog WBUR's The Wild Life. Thank you.
Thank you, Lisa.
Arizona has become the first state in the country to pass a controversial law about frozen embryos. It pertains to what happens to a frozen embryo from a married couple when the couple separates or gets a divorce. The law states the embryo should be given to whichever person wants to develop them, quote, to birth. Arizona Governor Doug Ducey signed the measure earlier this month. It's being praised by anti-abortion groups and criticized by those who say it's governmental intrusion into private lives. Nita Farahani is professor of law and philosophy at Duke University, and we've asked her to help us understand this law. Professor, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Why, in your view, is this law so significant, and what does it mean for the national conversation on personhood?
It's an interesting and significant departure from past practices with respect to what happens to embryos after a divorce. It used to be the case, and going back over 20 years now to the first case that dealt with this, Davis v. Davis, it usually respected the wishes of the parent who did not want to become a parent with the other party. If one party objected, then the other party didn't get the embryos to bring them to term. Now,
this does just the opposite.
Exactly. It does just the opposite. And it makes a person who does not wish to be a parent become a genetic parent. And it creates, a lot of emotional and financial ties to a child that a person may not have wanted to have with the party that they divorced with.
So let's see how this works in reality. I mean, there is a husband and a wife, and under this law, they would have to have been a married couple. They have not just a frozen egg, but an embryo they created together. So at some point, they took the action to try and have a child. The marriage didn't work out. So what happens then? Do they both have to say, state their case, I either want this embryo to become a child or not?
So what the law was before was both parties would have to agree. Both people would have to say, yes, we want to use that embryo to have a child, whether it's together or giving it to one party or the other one. For the man, perhaps a surrogate could bring it to term. For the woman, she might choose to transfer it herself. And most clinics have contracts that you have to sign before creating the embryos that specify what happens in the situation of divorce.
That's a huge
point.
This
law now trumps that.
Right. Yeah. So you had to decide beforehand. Before the emotions of a divorce get into play.
That's right. And this law trumps the contracts that the two parties had developed before, which had specified how they wanted to deal with the embryos post-divorce. And, on the one hand, there have been some cases that have done that. So women who created these embryos in their earlier reproductive years and are now of an age where they can no longer create eggs of their own that could be viable. In some of those cases, the women have been granted the right to use the embryos because it's their only chance to have a genetic child. But in most of the cases, the party that has not wanted to become a genetic parent or a parent, because it doesn't have to be their own genetic material, it has been their wishes that have trumped the other one, following most of actually abortion law, finding that the right to procreate or not procreate are both included within the constitutionally protected right to privacy that was recognized in Roe v. Wade. stayed by the U.S. Supreme Court.
What happens if both parents want a child?
That's an interesting and complicated question, and I don't know how the courts would resolve that. I assume that they would allow the woman, if she wanted to be the gestational carrier, to be the gestational carrier. But one of the interesting questions that this law raises is what happens with custody? Suppose that the man doesn't want to be a parent and the woman does. She's given the right to the embryos, brings the embryo to term, assuming it's successful. Many of these would fail to lead to a live birth. And she then wants to have sole custody. You know, is that going to be consistent with what existing law is? Probably not. Probably if he wanted to then have custodial rights, he would have custodial rights as well and might also have financial obligations for child support or other things.
I thought the law said that there wouldn't be an issue of child support.
If that's true, that's great. Although that's also, I'm not sure that that would be legitimate because it's ultimately what's in the best interest of a child. I think there's lots of provisions of this law that are going to end up being challenged in court.
And what happens if neither parent wants the embryo?
Usually the contracts have specified what happens. And so the contracts would say if neither party wants the embryos, either the embryos are destroyed or they could be donated for research. They might have also said that if neither party wants to use the embryos to become pregnant, that they might transfer it or donate it. There are embryo donations to other parents who or people who wish to become parents. And so they could choose to donate it to another individual or couple.
And just to be clear, obviously a man can't carry a child. So if he gets the right to the embryos in this case, how does that work?
So if a man wanted to have the embryo and the woman did not because the man wanted to bring it to term, presumably he would hire a surrogate or perhaps he has a new partner and his new partner is somebody who he would want to use the embryos with. This law would give him the right to do that.
Is there a part of the law that would require whoever gets custody of the embryo to then have a child? I mean, is this something that's watched over the years?
I don't think that that's something you could mandate in the law. So the idea is whichever parent wants the embryo with the intention of bringing a child into the world. And of course, you know, again, there's a very low success rate with many of these embryos. You know, if we're talking about three-day embryos, you know, maybe at best it's a 20% success rate. But regardless, it goes to the parent who declares their intention, not the one who offers any kind of guarantees. But, you know, an interesting question from that is what happens if they change their mind and then the other parent wants it and, you know, just kind of creates ongoing entanglement, which is contrary to all of divorce law, too.
So we're not talking about custody here. We're talking about rights over the use of an embryo. But in the case of divorce, things can be so tense and so messy that one would think that one of the parents could say, I want this, the right to this embryo. And then decide to have a child or not with the embryo.
Right. It's incredibly complicated. You know, you don't usually hear about people who get divorced deciding to have a child together after they've gotten divorced. And that's ultimately what this creates the possibility of is you could have incredibly contentious divorce disputes. People who are unable to really cooperate in any possible way suddenly thrust into becoming parents together and likely having custodial rights that are shared and having to figure out a way to work through that over a lifetime.
This might not sound like it's such a big issue in terms of how many people it affects, but more and more people are freezing embryos. How many embryos are frozen out there right now?
Most experts estimate that hundreds of thousands of embryos are being stored in fertility clinics around the country. And that has significant implications because many times these are stored earlier in a relationship and those relationships, you know, can fail. And most of those were created with existing contracts that specify what happens in case of a divorce. This suddenly potentially changes that and reopens what had been relatively settled law over the past 20 years about what happens to the disposition of embryos after divorce.
So when it comes to these cutting-edge technologies around genetics and reproduction, how well are the laws keeping up?
They're trying, right? I mean, a lot of these are being decided on a case-by-case basis in courts. And you see a lot of consistency with what the earliest case on this, Davis v. Davis, decided, siding with the parent who chose not to procreate, although that's been challenged by women who are beyond reproductive years and choose, you know, to want to use the embryo. So sometimes you see the court siding with that. There's some differences. This is a very big change to suggest that a legislative approach that recognizes whichever parent wants to use the embryo should have the right given to them. And I think it's going to end up likely being constitutionally challenged by the first parent who does not want to become a parent in one of these circumstances. And it'll be interesting to watch. It's going to likely change what some individuals choose to do. Rather than freezing embryos, they might decide to freeze eggs and freeze sperm separately for future use. And what we have found over time is that the future viability of the eggs and sperm are lower than future viability of embryos. So, you know, it's going to, I think, set some people backwards in their likelihood of success in an effort to avoid this problem in the future.
Thank you for speaking with us, Nita Farahani, professor of law and philosophy at Duke University. Nice to speak with you.
Likewise. Thank you.
School and city leaders in San Francisco are considering opening a temporary shelter for homeless students and their families in the gym of a public school. The proposal is said to be the first of its kind. San Francisco Supervisor Hillary Ronan proposed the idea. Supervisor Ronan, welcome to Here and Now.
Nice to be here with you.
Is the homeless problem getting so bad in San Francisco that it's come to this, opening up a homeless shelter in a gym?
Well, unfortunately, it is. It's not just in San Francisco. You know, years of failed housing policy coming out of Washington, the failure to invest in housing for our lowest income working families have got us to where we are today, where in the San Francisco Unified School District, there are over 2,000 children that are homeless or extremely housing insecure, meaning, you know, they might be sleeping on someone's couch or doubled or tripled up in a one-room SRO, single residency occupancy hotel room, that type of insecure housing situation.
And as you point out, San Francisco isn't alone. This is a problem across the nation. The National Center on Family Homelessness found that in 2013, about one in every 30 children was homeless. I mean, the focus of schools should be teaching and learning. And if you're homeless, that becomes a heck of a lot harder, yes?
Absolutely. And this was not my idea. I was actually visiting Buena Vista Horace Mann on a tour because I have a five-year-old who's entering kindergarten, and it's one of my top choices of schools. And when I was there, the vice principal pulled me aside and said, you know, we have 64 children in our school that are housing insecure. And several of these children have come up to me or our principal and asked if they could sleep in the gym at night. And she went on to tell me how difficult it is for these children to concentrate in class, that they are absent way more than housing secure students. And so it was the students themselves who, you know, by asking if they could stay in the school overnight, that gave the vice principal and the principal the idea. Mm. And so that's when they approached me and we started working to make it a reality.
Buena Vista Horace Mann is a K-8 school in the Mission District. I mean, how would this work? Would the gym be set up at night with cots and pillows and be taken down in the morning before school? Talk about how this might work.
This would be a fully funded program by the city of San Francisco. So we would contract out with a family shelter operator. So it wouldn't be any school district staff or funding that would set up an emergency overnight program every night in the school gym. There's enough space for about 60 beds, and they would be cots that are stored during the day. There would be a hot meal for all of the individuals that are staying there. And one thing I want to emphasize is this overnight program will only be for students who attend Buena Vista Horace Mann and their families. So we're not bringing anybody from outside the school community into the school.
Some parents at the school, while they said they're empathetic to this plight of homeless students, have raised concerns about logistics and safety and are saying that the school just needs major repairs and isn't ready. What's your response to that?
We are taking all of the parents' concerns very seriously. We are working with the principal, and I've been looking to try to get some private investment to do all of the repairs that, you know, parents are worried about. Some of them are directly related to this overnight program, and some are just separate.
Supervisor Ronan, kids can be pretty cruel. Are you worried at all about the potential stigma kids might face at school for sleeping in the gym, a sort of those are the homeless kids kind of cruelty?
Sure. That was my first concern when this idea was brought to me, was my first question. When I asked that question to the teachers and the administrators at the school, what they told me is that that is not a concern of theirs. We'll see what happens if this becomes a reality. But that is just not their concern, which I found very surprising.
What about those who say schools are already asked to do an awful lot? Adding homeless shelter to their list is pretty tough.
So, you know, in an ideal world, this absolutely would not be necessary. And I certainly have made it my top priority to be fighting at the state and federal level for a much greater investment in basic human right need to housing in local communities. But until that happens, this is a much better alternative than having kids sleep on the streets, in their cars, on people's couches, in potentially dangerous situations like they are doing now.
Hillary Ronan is a city supervisor in San Francisco. She's been speaking with us about her proposal to turn a gym at a K-8 public school in the city into a temporary homeless shelter for students and their families. Supervisor Ronan, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Eric Westervelt.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. This is Here and Now.